So we're going to be thinking this morning about home and rootedness and belonging, which are all quite emotive words, aren't they? And as we just said, I've just uprooted 6 months ago and rooted, I'm bedding in again. And so this is all quite raw for me at the moment. And I'm hoping that I'll be speaking a bit to myself as well, but I just want to acknowledge up front that it can be a painful thing to consider, and it can be an emotional thing to think about where home is, and especially if we don't feel particularly at home, and that can be for all kinds of reasons. Bath is really beautiful, but why is there a but there? Anyway, it sometimes can feel like living in a museum. Like every now and then I would just want to rip off my bonnet and graffiti all this beautiful yellow stone, and like, it's not really vicar's wife behaviour, is it? But I don't know. I'm sure like eventually I'll be like, I'm not living in a museum. This is like an actual city, and it's my city where I live, and I have some memories, and I don't expect to see Jane Austen coming around the corner in a horse and cart. But anyway, place, it takes a while. So my prayer is that we can dig into some of the ways that home can be established and reinforce for ourselves a sense of belonging, no matter what our circumstances. So I want to begin by telling you about someone who encapsulates rootedness for me. One of the most extraordinarily embedded people I've ever come across. In my old job, I used to have to go to this place called Cliff College quite a bit, and it's just north of a town called Chesterfield, which is like a mid-sized market town in Derbyshire, and it's mostly famous for its ever so slightly crooked church tower. And I'm trying to make Gary famous too now. So Gary is a taxi driver, and he picked me up from the station probably 3 or 4 times over the course of about a year. And I always recognised him because he's got very, very colourful tattoos over most of his body. And he recognised me because I used to ask him really odd and intrusive questions, like, where do taxi drivers go to the toilet? Have you ever wondered if you're in a car all day, where do you go to the loo? He's like, what an odd question. We find cafes. Okay, now I know. But so this one time I'd arrived from London. London was really grim and rainy, and Chesterfield was all bright and sparkly. So I said, Chesterfield's much nicer today than London. And this unleashed this torrent of praise and adoration of Chesterfield. And it took us the full 30-minute taxi drive for him to try and convey to me just how much he loves Chesterfield. I've never met such passion for a town. He has lived his whole life in Chesterfield, 7 generations before him also. He grew up a street from where the hospital he was born in, and then he now lives like 2 streets from that, along with all his family, and his wife's from there, obviously. As we were driving along, he pulled out his phone to show me through his pictures, and most of them were of Chesterfield, which was a bit unnerving because we were driving, and I could see Chesterfield out of the window of the taxi. He then said that he really struggles to even leave on holiday. Well, a few years ago, his wife convinced him to go on a package tour to Mallorca for a week. And about day 3, rioting broke out in London. He had this visceral need to go back home, and he ended the holiday early, returned to Chesterfield, and I just pictured him like on the perimeter with this cricket bat, but he felt like the rioting might spread up north and he had to be there to defend Chesterfield. And he actually ended his abroad holiday for this reason. I think that kind of connection is probably rare, but I thought it might be interesting to get a sense from this room how transient we all are. So if I could just have a show of hands, is there anyone here who has always lived in the same place? Have we got anyone? No one. Okay, how about always in the same town? Yeah? That's impressive. Okay, who's moved 2 to 5 times? What about 6 to 10? Yeah, quite a few. Over 10. Okay, let's see if we can get to who's moved them. I don't know, how do we get... over 20. And how about different countries? How many people have lived in over? No, no. What's your hand going up for though? Countries, different countries. Three countries. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, what about five countries? Three countries. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, we're pretty transient. I've moved so often when people say that, if you catch me at the wrong moment and someone says, where are you from? It can throw me into this kind of panic. And I had this whole period of time where our family had this kind of story that we all agreed on, that we'd say we were from Abingdon, which isn't like a total lie. My grandparents lived there. we were just so flummoxed by this whole matter of what to do when people ask you that question fairly often. We're like, okay, how do we get around this? Okay, we'll say Abingdon, we'll say we're from Abingdon. Charles Dickens wrote, home is a name, a word. It is a strong one, stronger than magician ever spoke or spirit ever answered to. The kitchen appliance company, Bosch, did a survey that found out that people move 8 times in their lifetime. I imagine their hope for doing that survey was to imply that you need 8 fridges, but you just put your fridge on your removal van, right, and take it. Not 8 fridges needed. But in 1990, 154 million people lived in a country they weren't born in. And by 2015, that number was 232 million. In London schools, there are 300 languages spoken. I'd be pushed to name that many languages. But it's not just place that we are in flux around. We change jobs, we move relationships. The environment itself is changing. We have a wife of a climate scientist here, and he would have a lot to say about, you know, quite acute and immediate change happening in the environment around us. It feels like things are constantly changing, and that can be really unsettling. In our last church, we fundraised for several years to do some much-needed renovation. The carpet was properly gross, and you couldn't spill something that would show up because there were so many layers of other spillages, which was actually one of my favourite things about that church, to the point where when we left, they gave me a square of it framed because we reached our fundraising goal and we were able to pull it up. And when they made the announcement that we had got to this goal, my Karis, who was 7 at the time, everyone was cheering and clapping, and I looked down and she was in absolute floods of tears because of change, because it was her church and she loved it and it was going to look different. And my Alexa is like this old biddy. If she spots like a new building going up or something, she's like, shouldn't be putting this, it's all crowded enough already. I think children particularly just don't like change. It hits to the sense of home that they have. So I want to have some little pauses for chat around the table, and this is first one. I wonder, I know some of us are happy disclosing to any old person like me, here I am disclosing, but if you're not, there's one question that's more personal and one that's more kind of safe and ideas-based, okay? So first question that you could talk about, when did you last feel unsettled or homesick, and what was it for and what prompted it? Second question, other than an address, what does home mean? What are the things that go into a concept of home? So we'll have maybe 5 minutes on that, and I'll be back. Okay, if we could hit pause. Hopefully this will be the beginning of some longer conversations. I know there'll be some good stories in this room. So when I was 21, I felt quite deeply and profoundly homeless. I'd arrived in Vancouver, Canada, to do a master's in theology, and I moved into a house with 7 Canadian students who had a lot of fun with my accent. So, can you say party and water? Okay, again, find something more fun to do with your time. I had an English passport. My parents were English. My accent was pleasingly English to everyone around me. And I had arrived most recently from England, but England didn't feel even remotely like home at that point. I was born in Crawley, as we said, and I lived in England till I was five, from Crawley to Bristol to Merseyside. And my dad was training to be a vicar, and in that context, you do a three-year training post called a curacy. And he did that in a church in Merseyside. And I remember feeling quite a strong sense of belonging in that church. I felt quite important because my dad had a job there, so we were always there long after everyone had left, running up and down the aisles and under the pews. And I felt like people knew me there, that it was kind of my place. When I was five, we all moved to the Algarve, hard missionary posting. my parents founded a Christian conservation charity called Arosha. Most of those years, we lived in a field study centre with lots of other people, although there was about five house moves as well during those 12 years. So from 5 to 17, I lived in Portugal. The community life was really great for someone like me who is an extrovert. I loved that there were always people at home. First question off the school bus was, who's at home? And I would arrive back and like rush off and form new relationships, but goodbyes were really hard. And the kind of atmosphere in the house changed a lot, and it felt kind of constantly shifting. At 13, I came over to boarding school in Cheltenham, not the ladies' college. I wasn't super happy at school. Portugal remained in my mind very much my home. Interestingly, my siblings went to school in Bath, and they talk about that time as Bath being their home. So, but for me, it was definitely Portugal. When I was 17, my parents left Portugal, but not to go anywhere. They went on this kind of open-ended sabbatical. We called them the middle-aged travellers. And it ended up lasting 2 years, and they would go to different places and teach about the environmental work they'd been doing, or do some fundraising, this, that, and the other. And we had all our mail as a family directed through Abingdon, so kind of legitimate connection to Abingdon there. Furniture and storage. Technically, I guess we didn't have a base though for 2 years. And during that time, I left school and went off to Zimbabwe for a year to work in a rural primary school and teach on an AIDS awareness program. So when I came back, it was to southern France where they had moved. And I remember being picked up from Nice Airport and driven through this amazing, hot, smelly night. You know how France is like really, really heavy with lavender and dust, and it's really potent. And I remember thinking like, oh, this smell, maybe this smell is going to be really important to me. So I have to like sniff it up. But I was 19 by then, and I sort of went back and forth from there to Birmingham where I studied. And then straight from there, I went off to Canada, where I ended up living 4 years. And so that's why, at that point, I just had absolutely no clue where home was. I was close to my family, but they were a long way away. It was the time when email you had to disconnect the phone line, and all your housemates would get mad with you, and then it would go, and I'd have just enough time to download my email, but not to send any. It was really, yeah, communications come away. I'd come with a backpack and a suitcases. There were boxes of my stuff in Charlie and Anita's basement, which 4 years later, most of which had gone kind of mouldy and was really random stuff. Like, I remember unpacking the boxes and going, why did I not chuck this? There was this like snow globe with a dolphin inside it, for example. It's like, yeah, it was important to me at the time, obviously. I didn't know what I wanted to do for my studies after Regent. And I was kind of giving up on the idea that home would ever be a thing for me. It was in some ways a bleak conclusion, but I tried to turn it into a positive. I decided that I was actually onto a really holy path here. I was a pilgrim. I was like Abraham. I could go anywhere and God could send me, you know, wherever, and I'd go, because that's how holy I was. And I looked down on people who tied themselves to mortgages or who planned to return after their studies to this place that mattered to them, because I was like, yes, but our heavenly home. you are so, yeah. But I think actually it was because I was really sad and a bit lost. And I took a class called the Christian Imagination during my first year, and you had to do an arty project. I had made friends with a real artist, like a real genuine wacky artist called Linda, and she had this art studio which was a glass box that went out over onto the water, and she'd do all these kind of projects that were really meaningful and quite ugly. Like she had this thing going where she'd get everyone to give them her dryer lint, and then she'd like mush it up with water and glue and like make community, like things that meant community or something. So she was doing this technique where you do a really nice painting and then you blow soapy water all over it. So I went and did this tree and blew soapy water all over it and wrecked it. But the tree was in space. It was free floating in this big black space. Like it was like a tree in space, and it was a very happy tree. It had flares because it was so happy it had flares. And my point about the tree was that how great it is to be rootless. And my professor, after I had shown my class my mess of a thing and explained it, he looked really sadly at me and said, "Trees actually can't survive in space, Joe. Trees need soil and roots. You have like." And then he, for the next 2-3 years, he kept talking to me about this and about how place is not incidental and people matter and specifics of time and place and community matter, and that I shouldn't give up on home. That was a self-defense mechanism, actually. So I began to rethink conclusions about home and belonging and place and community, and I'm still working on it. I'm sure you're all familiar with Jeremiah 29, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper and not to harm you, to give you a future and a hope." I think it's probably one of the most misapplied verses in the Bible, because we take it and we put on it all our hopes and dreams, and we say, look, there's proof, God's promised that he'll give us whatever it is we need at the time. People might have written it on a card when we're going for a job, or when we have an offer on a house and it looks like it's going to fall through. We say, oh, well, God's plans are good, and you know, this house is a good idea, so he's going to, you know, he's planned it. If you actually look at what God was promising through Jeremiah, it's harder and also better. It's part of a prophecy given to the Jewish people in exile in Babylon. They had found their home, they'd been given the promised land, and they'd built up a city and a culture and put roots down and were living in this promised place that God had led them to and was very much part of their identity as God's people. And over years and years had turned a deaf ear to various prophets' calls to turn back to God and worship him and not the other foreign gods, and to live for him. And eventually it gets so hard and so rough that what the punishment side of things happens, and they're marched out of their land. And so here they are, somewhere they're really, it isn't home, it's not where they should be. They're desperate to get back. So around the Jeremiah 29 verses that we all know, this is, and you probably know this too, but because you're all really into your Bibles, this is the other bits from verse 4 on. "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper." This is somewhere they don't want to be. It's not their place. And God is saying to them, invest here. You're not leaving anytime soon. "This is what the Lord Almighty says. Do not let the prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Don't listen to the dreams you encourage them to have. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord." So this is what the Lord said when 70 years are completed for Babylon, so beyond the lifetime of most people listening, "I will come and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you, to give you a hope and a future." And the hope in the future ultimately is in Jesus and is in our forever home that's coming because of him. And you'll call on me and come and pray to me and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. And I will be found by you, declares the Lord. And the Lord is to be found here, here, nowhere else, this moment and this place. Settle down, plant gardens, get married, work for the good of your community and your city. Even if it's not where you want to be, a long way from where you feel you belong. This is it for now, so invest. And I know that Oxford is a place that has a lot of people for short-term reasons, students and business things and flux, but it's we never really know how long we'll be anywhere, and it's a matter of kind of grasping and forcing those roots down at the risk of being hurt when you leave, but also at the gain of causing everyone around you to prosper and your own sense of belonging. So there are a lot of situations that can cause us to question where our place in the world is. I've talked to a lot of people, for example, who having grandchildren in another country is massively disruptive. Perhaps you've just moved house, maybe just down the street, but still. Maybe your marriage is breaking up, or you thought you'd be married and you're not, and you find it hard to accept that and make home in the moment on your own. Or maybe there was a time and place that you really did belong, and it's nothing is ever going to live up to that. For me, for a long time, this house Cruzinha that I lived in Portugal was the impossible place that I was exiled from, and I was never going to recreate it, and it made it impossible. But or perhaps it's to do with work. I think work has a lot to do with home. Unemployment can be a deeply unsettling experience, or even being promoted or shifting offices, having one of your best work friends leave. But if you're in that place of feeling unsettled, rootless, homesick, or restless, don't give up on the hope of finding home. We're made for belonging, and we're made to need a safe place to call home. It's part of the Maslow pyramid of needs. Most of them are met in the context of home, shelter, food, you know that. You're very clever, you'll know all the pyramid, but home is not incidental. We do need somewhere to belong. We need to find a home. So four things to finish with that might help build home. Firstly, allow God to make his home in you. Revelation 3:20 has this beautiful domestic picture. Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person and they with me. There's this life sharing going on. When Jesus was talking about leaving his closest friends in the Last Supper, he said that they were going to have, it was a genuine goodbye, but also he would be remaining with them because the Holy Spirit would be inside them, a constant presence, source of peace, security, and guidance. Investing in our relationship with God, the picture in the Bible is of putting your roots down by a stream where drought can come, high winds can come, all kinds of things, but you still have your roots being nourished from the water of life coming up, and you're anchored then. The second thing is to cultivate contentment. There's a brilliant children's book by the author, the team that did the Gruffalo, called A Squash and a Squeeze. I don't know if you're familiar. An old lady is finding her house too small, and she moans about it dangerously in these situations. Never moan to a wise old man. He tells her the solution. Well, get a very big mortgage. You'll be in debt. Might stop you having other things in life, but you can probably get a mortgage and move to a bigger house. But actually, he doesn't say that. He's a wise old man. So he asks her to bring some farmyard animals into the house. Bigger and bigger farmyard animals, one at a time, until she can barely move. And eventually she's like, okay, I don't think I can fit any more in now, wise old man, what shall I do? And she's allowed to let them all out when suddenly the house is calm and quiet and clean. And she's very, very happy. I think sometimes we just have to look at our situation with slightly different eyes. We have to embrace where we are, the people that we're with. Make a choice to live now in this place with these people and be grateful and look for things to love. Sometimes we have to choose not to be envious and look over the garden fence and wish we had somewhere else. Thirdly, something I've found helpful is knowing and telling my story, weaving it into a narrative. In the Old Testament, the Jewish people told and retold and retold their stories. They came into being with a promise made to Abraham. He would be the father of a nation, conceiving a child with his wife in extreme old age. They were given a land, saved from a famine. They grew numerous. They were rescued from slavery, fed in the desert. They were special and chosen, and this was a narrative that pieced together their identity and their sense of who they were and who they belonged to. Our stories weave the fragments of our lives together, and they help us to see meaning, purpose, and direction. So, next chatty bit for you guys. In just a few minutes, could you tell someone next to you either about your favourite childhood bedroom or about a painting or a piece of furniture that you have that has particular significance to you? I'll just get some stories out there. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. Man, I wish I could have heard everybody's stories. I have a bottomless pit of an appetite for stories, and I can see there's some good ones happening that I can't hear, so that's kind of irritating me, but I'm glad you're telling each other. Some people call it nosiness, but anyway. So, last way of making home that has been a good one for me is to offer hospitality. And I don't mean that in like an official dinner party, get stressed out all day over a hot cooker and then pretend you're like serene as anything. And not that. I just mean like being available, making your whatever space you have, however small, however scruffy, available and comfortable for other people. Being a welcoming person, even. There are people, I'm sure you can think of them, who make you feel at home around them. Just being in their company lets you kind of settle down and feel safe and okay, and that you belong. Sometimes hospitality is scary, though, especially if you don't feel like you have a shiny, perfect sort of dining space. But this really hit home for me as a way that hit me as a way that home can be reinforced last summer, because I was talking to a group and this woman in the middle put her hand up to ask a question, which ended up being quite a long story. And it was a really sad story. And her question ended up being, so what about me? How can I be at home? But the kind of, it was a bit like a Job scenario. So it all began when she had this perfect idyllic home. I don't know if I remember this wrong, but my picture was like, it was like in this woodland glade, and like people would come and have cream teas on her front garden. And I think she had a husband who sold wood burning stoves. It was like all very, she had sons, and it was like so perfect and lovely. And bit by bit, everything got taken from her. Her husband left, and with all the money, one of her sons died, the other one moved to Australia. She ended up sort of destitute and miserable and alone in this tower block. And she said, I don't know anyone. My tower block feels unsafe. No one in my whole time of living there has asked me for a cup of tea. And I was kind of praying desperately inside for wisdom. I didn't know how to lift the mood of the room. Like, we were all feeling fairly hopeless and sad with her. And all I could think to say was, have you asked any of your neighbours over for a cup of tea? And something like, her eyes twinkled a little bit. And at the end, she came back and she was like, thank you, I feel like I have a plan now. I'm gonna go and find, there must be other people in my block who feel like me, and I'm gonna have tea with them. And she felt like maybe that was gonna be the start of her finding home in this really bleak scenario. So if we have somewhere to open to others, it reminds us we have somewhere. So the four things were: allow God to make his home with you, cultivate contentment, know and tell your story, and offer hospitality. As a Christian, I do have this hope and expectation that all the moving and all the unsettledness and this feeling of impermanence, it's not going to be like that always. There is a proper home waiting, but I also am convinced that home is to be found now for all of us. We don't have to wait, and home is here and home is now too. And that is all I'm going to say.